Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening. Wherever you get your podcast, we appreciate that. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to think you are a hater. Coming up on this episode of The Right Time, we will talk to you about guys skipping the FIBA World Cup. We used to care about Team USA basketball, didn't we? Also, basketball players going a little broke. Chris Paul's got a solution for them, but first... All right, guys, we're going to be honest about this. It's that time of year where we kind of scraping the bowl on coming up with stuff to talk to y'all about. Like we really, really are. I do a television show. We do a conference call every morning. And sometimes I get on the call and I'm like, good job, y'all, for figuring out what we're going to do on television all day long. Because this is the slow period of our year. And so when this happens in our business every now and then, what winds up happening is people decide that they're going to go and they are going to lean on things that they like to talk about all the time. And I have a couple of topics that like once or twice a year I like to bring up and discuss. And the one that we are going to go to today is the greatness of Barry Bonds. Now, I understand that not a lot of y'all do the baseball thing like that anymore. Hell, I don't really do the baseball thing like that anymore. I also understand that some of y'all really dislike Barry Bonds because he has a fairly extended track record of being a jerk. I get all of those things. But every now and then something happens that reminds me, y'all don't know how good Barry Bonds is. Now, of course, we're talking about this on the heels of the Hall of Fame induction ceremony, which was this weekend, where, among others, Harold Baines went in the Hall of Fame. And let's take a moment to consider the fact that Harold Baines is in the Hall of Fame and Barry Bonds is not.
Now, I know what you're thinking. Barry used steroids.
Yeah, we'll kind of get to that point in just a second. But one argument I have with people on the Internet very often, Gabe, I don't know if you've seen me get into this one with people. Have you seen me have to argue with people about whether Barry Bonds is better than Ken Griffey Jr.?
Oh, I've seen it.
Yeah, and, you know, and I understand that if you are a little young to even like fully participate in this conversation, but you got to understand that Ken Griffey Jr., he was probably, in terms of persona and visibility, as close to being a basketball player as anybody has ever been. Like, that is how he was pushed. That's how he was marketed. His giant Nike campaign behind him. I can't think of a baseball player that's ever gotten a push in the way that Ken Griffey Jr. did. Ken Griffey Jr. also, it should be noted, played his games, his home games in Seattle at a time when we wasn't really watching that much baseball. We didn't really have access to that much baseball on television. And so what you got from Griffey was a marketing campaign, some fly shoes, and SportsCenter. And I don't know how many baseball players have ever been more SportsCenter ready than Ken Griffey Jr. I don't. I cannot tell you that. I do want to take a moment and tell you this, though. Barry Bonds has a career OPS of 1051. It is 1051. That is his career OPS. And yes, that includes the video game era of Barry Bonds, when honestly, like, alleged steroid Barry Bonds is the most unreal thing I've ever seen. Anyway, do you know how many times in his career that Ken Griffey Jr. had an OPS over 1.051? You want to guess, Gabe?
10 times.
Zero.
0 times. Zero. Wow, I went the other way on that one.
Zero, which is to say the average Barry Bonds season is better than the best Ken Griffey Jr. season. Yes. Yes. You didn't see that coming, did you? The average Barry Bonds season is better than the best Ken Griffey Jr. season. The best Ken Griffey Jr. OPS season. I'm working this off the phone, so I got to do a lot of forward back at the same time. The best that Ken Griffey Jr. put up on OPS, 1.076. So I apologize. He had one season better than Barry Bonds' career best. Like, we're not talking about the same dude, man. We are talking about cats that are completely different calibers of player. In fact, at his best, Barry Bonds, by the advanced metrics, was a better defensive player than Ken Griffey Jr. was. Ken Griffey Jr. is a better defensive player than Jim Edmonds was, but there's a heavy factor of Jim Edmonds in that Jim Edmonds got the mad, insane highlights, and so it kind of inflates in your mind exactly what he was. No. Baseball players since World War II. There is Barry Bonds and Mike Trout, who we have to now put in this. It's Barry Bonds and Mike Trout, and then it is everybody else. He is that dude. And I wind up in this all the time with people. It's the same argument. And what happens is people just want to put on a cape for their favorite player. And I understand wanting to put on the cape for your favorite player. We all got a favorite player. We all got a cape, right? Like every now, and we all enjoy doing these things from time to time. But y'all need to understand, Barry Bonds is just a completely different caliber of player than Griffey was. It's not his fault. You know, every like Kate, they can only be one boss, right? We all agree on that. They can only be one boss. It just so happens that that boss is Barry Bonds. Like, do you, Gabe, I imagine you have a recollection of the video game Barry Bonds, right?
Oh, I do. I mean,
you're from up there.
Yeah, I mean, my like childhood was Barry Bonds hitting home runs into the bay.
Yes. In a place that nobody else hit home runs.
Correct. I mean, I still have the SF Chronicle from when he broke the home run record back at my house in Napa.
Yo, like, I just go through, if you ever get bored, just go through Barry Bonds' baseball reference page, and it is staggering what you ultimately see. Now, the line that doesn't get highlighted enough, but is the most important line in Barry Bonds' career, is 1998. 1998, Barry Bonds in 156 games, hit 37 homers, 122 RBI, stole 28 bases. This is also the year after, no, this is not the year after, it's 2 years after the 40-40. It was the year after a 40-37. 37 homers, 28 stolen bases, 120 runs scored, 303, 438, 609. And this is allegedly, according to Jeff Perlman's book, Love Me, Hate Me, when Barry Bonds was with Ken Griffey Jr. and he says to him, I just had a great year and nobody cares. Everybody's talking about McGuire and Sosa. Well, fine. If that's what your game is going to be, then I'm just going to go out here and take whatever it takes to get this done. And Griffey was like, nah, I'm tapping out. I'm not going to do this. Bonds was like, okay, I am. And then after that, what the result was video game Barry Bonds. That is what we had. Now, there's an argument I make, and I've been making this argument honestly now for almost 15 years. And I don't think enough is made of this because people just don't like Bonds. Bonds was made into the face of steroid use, right? Now, I do think, to be fair, that part of that reason was because he was so damn good and it was impossible to imagine anybody being as good as he was from 2001 to 2004 in particular. It was impossible to think of anybody being that good. So I could see why it is that he winds up being the face of this thing. But the truth is, the argument that should be made is that Barry Bonds is actually a victim of the steroid era and not so much at the forefront of pushing it. Because the argument for banning performance-enhancing drugs is very simple. You ban them not because they make people better, but because they make people better at the expense of their own bodies. You are asking people when they do that, or they are themselves, rather, mortgaging their futures for present-day success. Now, what you don't want to wind up in is a situation where other people feel pressure to do the same because that is what is necessary to keep up in the name of competition. Right. You put these rules in place to protect players and specifically to protect your best players because you want your best players to actually be the best. Right. We want to have what is deemed a level playing field, and that's fine. And so you have the level playing field, but there are going to be some people who excel. You want the people who excel and who get to the top to be the ones who get there fairly. That's how you keep this whole thing afloat. But then when you got McGuire and Sosa out here doing their thing, and to remind you how nuts the steroid thing was. Howard Bryant makes this point. Sammy Sosa had three seasons of 60 or more home runs. In none of those seasons was he the home run champion. Right. There are dudes that hit 60 home runs that you don't even remember hitting like 50, 60 home runs, right? They have the Brady Anderson types and ones that jump off the page and stuff like that. But this guy, you don't even remember in that place. You're supposed to stop Brady Anderson from doing this stuff, allegedly, and hitting 50 home runs so that Barry Bonds doesn't look up one day and say, how the hell did Brady Anderson hit 50 home runs? Brady Anderson has more 50 home run seasons than Hank Aaron and as many 50 home run seasons as Barry Bonds. Yeah, it's right there. It's directly in front of you. That's what you got. No, the game let Barry Bonds down. People just don't like to think of it that way because, hey, he's a cheater. But come on, man. Y'all act like y'all ain't humans. You act like you ain't been living in this world and don't know how things work. Like, yeah, allegedly Barry Bonds cheated. I have to say allegedly because I don't want to go to court. But allegedly Barry Bonds got out here and cheated. I'm not one of those people that's going to deny that. I'm also not one of those people who hit you with the, yeah, well, maybe he used that stuff, but that don't improve your hand-eye coordination. I mean, come on, dog. Go look at the numbers. It improved something. It may not have made it to where he wasn't hitting baseballs that he could not hit, but damn it, he was hitting them farther than he ever had before. Like, there's no denying that part. And there is a tragedy to an extent that comes up in that after Bonds has done this, it becomes a justification for other people to wipe out the entirety of his career that came before it and to act like what happened in Pittsburgh or what happened for him in the first 6 or 7 years in San Francisco didn't happen. Like, they didn't count. It's nothing. And this dude isn't quite Alex Rodriguez, right? Well, we've definitely done that to Alex Rodriguez, but it's a lot harder to go up and down the Alex Rodriguez stats and find a place to point to where you're like, oh, well, that's where Alex Rodriguez started doing this. You can do it very easily with Barry Bonds. And guess what? The point with Barry Bonds at which you point at that on his baseball reference page, there is a whole, not exaggerating, a whole Hall of Fame career that comes before that. At the time, Barry Bonds had 400. He had already had 400 home runs before we wind up in the stuff with him, right? At that point, I believe there were all of two players who had career 400 home runs who were eligible for the Hall of Fame who did not get in. I believe those two guys were Darrell Evans and Dave Kingman, right? Now, Darrell Evans, I guess you could make, like, he'll be one of the veterans committee sort of cases when it comes up. And Dave Kingman was just absolutely not a Hall of Famer. But those are the only two guys that were that hadn't gotten to that rarefied air at that point, who hadn't gotten to the Hall of Fame, who had 400 home runs. I think he had 400 home runs and 400 stolen bases before we even start talking anything about Barry Bonds, maybe using that dope. That dude's a Hall of Famer. And that dude's a Hall of Famer in a Ralph Kiner-like time period. I think Ralph Kiner played something like 10 years, and he got in the Hall of Fame. Barry Bonds, 86 to 98. We're talking about 13. And please keep in mind that those numbers that Barry Bonds was putting up in San Francisco are at one of the legendary pitcher's parks that there has ever been. Like, hey, listen to some of these numbers. This is Barry Bonds' on-base percentage from 1990 to 1998. You ready? 406, 410, 456, 458, 426, 431, 461, 446, 438. Let's look at that 461. That was in 1996. Any chance, Gabe, you remember who was the MVP in 1996?
I was like 5 years old. So
you might have been like me and read almanacs for fun as a kid. And I did do that. I got a lot cooler as the years went on. Ken Caminiti won that year. And Ken Caminiti, rest in peace, but we found out that he was one of these guys that was on that juicy juice. This is how out of hand stuff was, Gabe. Barry Bonds had 42 home runs, had 129 RBIs, had 40 stolen bases, was only caught 7 times, walked 151 times versus 76 strikeouts. It had an OPS of 1.076, and he did not win the MVP. Not only did he not win the MVP, let me go check where, yeah, he was fifth in a year with a gold glove and a silver slugger. He was fifth. Don't nobody weep for Barry Bonds about that stuff, right? We can go to 1997. 97, Barry Bonds, 40 homers, 101 RBIs, 37 stolen bases, 145 walks against 87 strikeouts because Bonds never struck out 100 times after his rookie year. He hit a mere 291 but got on base at 446, an OPS of 1031. Barry Bonds finished fifth in the MVP voting that year. 1998, which, as I recall, is the year that Barry Bonds was once intentionally walked with the bases loaded. Yeah, that's the 37, 122, 130 walks, 92 strikeouts, 303, 438, 609. Bonds finished eighth in the MVP voting that year. But he's the one you're whining about? Like, he's the one that causes people the most problems? That guy? Nah, man. That dude was let down by the game around him. Now, my guess is at some point they're going to have to let all these cats in that was on the juice. And you know why they're going to have to let all them cats in that were on the juice? Because they got to let somebody in. Like, we're running out of people that you can, like, that you can talk about without some measure of skepticism who they happen to be. You know, I guess Derek Jeter going to get himself in there at some point, not too long. Everybody can feel good about that one. But we're running out of guys that you can really talk about in that way. So unless they want to just kind of stop having Hall of Fame ceremonies, they're going to wind up letting some of these dudes in. I actually think that there's some room to make some decisions about who should or should not get in. If you want to keep Mark McGwire out on the basis of using the juice, that's fine. You want to keep Sammy Sosa out, that's fine. Because in the end, they were just home run hitters. And take away the home runs, what are we talking about? We're not talking about Hall of Fame baseball players if we take away the home runs there. Bonds, we are. We are. People just don't like him. And that's largely his own fault, and that is by his own admission. But I'll say this, even if they never let Bonds in the Hall of Fame, because I'm not really one for external validation in that way. And Gabe, you can probably verify this. He'll always have San Francisco.
What's interesting about Bonds is there was this kind of love-hate relationship even with his own fans.
Well, they could only hate him so much as he is the reason that they have a team.
That is a fair point.
Like, he saved baseball in San Francisco. There it is. Like, he'll always have a home. Alex Rodriguez doesn't have a home. In fact, Alex Rodriguez has a home. That home is Miami. His name is on the stadium at the University of Miami where he donated money, though he never attended. Barry Bonds always has San Francisco. Barry Bonds always has that ballpark. Barry Bonds will always have that. He won't have the Hall of Fame. Okay, fine. I'm just asking you, when you think about it, just have a little bit of good sense. And please understand that he is a better ball player than Ken Griffey Jr. could have ever dreamed of being. All right, man. Gabe, was it this year that the FIBA World Cup is?
Yes, it's this summer.
It's this summer. Who's going to be on the team? Because all I keep hearing about who's not going to be on the team.
Yeah, I mean, they're getting like really far down deep in the roster. Like when Brad Beal and Tobias Harris are saying no, then it's like, all right, we got to come knocking on D'Angelo Russell's door. That's like when you've gone too far.
Well, also, this means they're probably not going to win it this year. Like the 2004 team, the one that caused everybody such great consternation because they did not win it, that team won a bronze medal. And by the way, if you go look up and down the roster of that team, it's actually pretty good. There's some guys that you'll look at and be like, damn, I don't know how you made it on the team. But overall, that roster is pretty damn strong, but it wasn't a team. It was a strong roster, but it wasn't a team. So they went out there and they got embarrassed when they played in Greece. And, of course, Larry Brown was probably the wrong guy to have coached that team. A whole lot of stuff that was going on there with it. You know, here's the thing. You know how crazy it was with that 2004 Olympic team when the only guy that came off the team with his reputation improved by playing for his country was Allen Iverson. Literally, Allen Iverson, because Allen Iverson only knows how to play super hard, and there was no way to ignore the fact that Allen Iverson was playing way harder than everybody else. You know, part of why he was playing way harder than everybody else, though, is because everybody else is like, yo, what's going on with Larry Brown? And that was just another day in the life for Allen Iverson. Like, he knew how to deal with that. But now all these guys are saying that they don't want to go play in the World Cup, and it's going to be interesting to see, like, how this plays out even as we get toward the Olympics. Because what I think they managed to do with USA Basketball was they made it, I don't know if attractive is the right word, but they made it cool to go play for Team USA. Like, it used to be a thing where after the Olympics in 92, 96, and 2000, I think everybody from USA Basketball down to the players just felt like we could send 12 guys over there and we cool. Like, they beat our college guys that one time. Then we sent over all these pros. And then it's like, cool, our pros are better than everybody else. And then the world kind of caught up. And then the U.S. started paying more attention to it. Guys were more serious about competing in these international competitions. They put in more regulations or rules about guys coming in and practicing, you know, and being in these camps and everything like that. And it became like the super hangout for NBA players. It became part of these teams getting together, like these so-called super teams getting together because guys were getting cool while they were playing for Team USA. The thrill is gone. Like, these cats are looking around and they're like, nah, man, we're good. We don't feel like doing that. So here are the guys who say they are now not going. Anthony Davis and James Harden. Eric Gordon and CJ McCollum. Brad Beal says he's not going. These other guys are not going to be there. LeBron James, Kevin Durant, Steph Curry, Kawhi Leonard, Russell Westbrook, Klay Thompson, obviously. Kevin Durant, obviously. Draymond Green, DeMarcus Cousins, though he shouldn't be on the team. Blake Griffin, Paul George, Kyrie Irving. All right. So they say, I'm getting this from a piece on SB Nation. They say that of the guys who made an all-NBA team, the only two that are going to go to the FIBA World Cup are Damian Lillard and Kemba Walker.
Yeah, want me to give you a list of who else is going?
Go for it.
Harrison Barnes.
Oh.
Andre Drummond.
Oh.
Kyle Kuzma.
Really?
Free agent. He doesn't have an agent right now. Potential clutch client. Brooke Lopez. Kevin Love. Kyle Lowry, who's coming off of thumb surgery, so we'll see how effective he is. Chris Middleton. Paul Millsap. Donovan Mitchell. Jason Tatum. PJ Tucker. Miles Turner. And the aforementioned Kemba Walker.
We send a PJ Tucker to represent us in front of the world.
Exactly.
We send a Brooke Lopez to represent us in front of the world.
That was a very quiet selection. You notice it's not like they were announced.
No, there's no
like
press
the
release.
Miami Heat Big Three or something like that. And representing the U.S., Brooke Lopez.
Okay, so they're not going to win this. Do we feel good about saying this? That we're not going to win this?
Well, when you think about like what other countries could win this in terms of like the heat of their roster, what's unfortunate is like the Australian national team could be pretty dope, but Ben Simmons is not playing either.
So does the guys just generally not want to do this?
Yeah, part of it is this getting pushed back to this year. It was supposed to be last year, then it's this year. So now they're missing two summers in a row if they're doing the Olympics next year. And then there's a lot of preseason stuff that's going on where different players are, you know, like the Rockets are going to Japan. So then you've got Harden out there, Russell Westbrook out there too. It's almost just like the NBA calendar as like an international community isn't in sync quite to the point where they place emphasis on these tournaments so that the guys actually have like enough time to rest and enough time off.
Because, you know, Mark Cuban has long now wanted to send his guys to go participate in international competitions. And his point is fair. I pay these guys a lot of money. Totally get it. Now, I don't know if you know about this, but FIBA has wanted to de-emphasize the Olympics and to move its primary basketball competition to the World Cup. Like, they want to turn that World Cup into something similar to the Soccer World Cup, which doesn't work simply because there's not as much parity around the world in basketball as there is in soccer. So we expect the United States to win every year in this, and it is a shock if they don't. And so I don't know if you can generate the kind of worldwide interest in the FIBA World Cup just because not everybody feels like they got a chance to win or even like really go deep in a way that they feel in soccer. Like I just don't think it exists in that same space. But this is my thought on this. Losing to the Soviet Union in 1998, I don't believe it was the sign that other people made it, that it was time to go to the pros. I think the thing that happened there was that other countries used their professionals, and so therefore it was felt as though the playing field was not level. All right, cool. I'm not sure whether they should do it with the World Cup or whether they should do it with the Olympics, but I feel like with one of those, they should do like they do with soccer with the Olympics. Well, Gabe, what is it? It's like a U24 in soccer, I think.
Basically, yeah.
It's U24 and you get like a couple of guys, like a couple wild cards.
The selection is, okay, we're going to send some guys out there who we maybe want to see a little bit more experience on the national stage.
Right.
So that you can then play it up for a World Cup.
Right. Got you. So to me, if they want to make the FIBA World Cup the thing, then make the Olympics U24. For everybody. And if they do that, the United States will still win. But what it'll also do is I think it'll allow you to get some additional promotion for some of your younger players. Because I do think we're at a point now in the NBA where it used to be we knew who the stars are going to be the second they walked into the league. That's not really the case right now. And so I think there would be a real value into having these guys play in the Olympics and to get the Olympics back on regular NBC and not on the NBC Sports Network, though I understand why you would make a move like that if you ran a television network. Basically, the Olympics are sports for a general audience, and the people who really care about the basketball team are going to be real sports fans. So you put that stuff like on the sports tier, and then probably as a way to try to get more people to subscribe to whatever that network is. But the general Olympics fan is not really in it for sports. They're in it for stories. And so that is what, I mean, like, I get it. It makes sense. But I think you'd be more likely to find these stories and things that people could get behind if you just had a younger team. Because one thing, and I talked about this in a slightly different context last week, but one thing that does bother me is that this country never roots for the Olympic basketball team. It never roots for its national basketball team in spite of the fact that they're really, really good. And you could make this argument, well, you know, Americans love underdogs. No, they don't. Like, not really. They kind of sort of do. But one thing Americans don't like is losing. They like the underdog if they like who the underdog is. If they don't like who the underdog is, you're not an underdog. You're just not that good. But one thing America loves is a juggernaut. That is how we view ourselves. We see ourselves around the world as a juggernaut. USA basketball is a juggernaut, men's and women's, an outright juggernaut, and this country does not embrace it in the same way. If you want to make the argument that Americans love juggernauts, that does not jibe with the support of the U.S. women's national team in soccer, because they are nobody's juggernaut. They are the favorite in this. They're absolutely the favorite in this. But if they want to make this work and make it something like where guys go to it, then I think that for the big team, either make it the Olympics or make it the World Cup, but they do that once every 4 years. And then the other time is for the youngsters. And see, to me, if you send the youngsters out there, will you win it every time? No. But that's kind of better for everybody. Like, I think that makes the young guys then ultimately want it more if it's not going to be that easy. It creates a different level of challenge, and you also get to a place where your camp becomes kind of a hierarchy, right? Like, it kind of creates some battles amongst those guys. Yeah, they might, you know, pal up and decide who to go, like, join as free agencies, but also bet it'll make those young guys a lot better on some iron sharpens iron kind of thing. That's the way that I would wind up playing this. But I also understand and don't really blame these dudes for being like, nah, man, I don't really feel like doing this. Like, especially these grown men, like Brad Beal's got a kid coming, right?
Correct.
He's like, yeah, nah, I'm good. I'm gonna go ahead and just hang out and do this stuff. Like, these dudes, as they get older, they ain't necessarily trying to play basketball on that level all summer long. And let me tell you something else, too. You must know these cats really don't want to play or just got other reasons. You know what a World Cup is this year, right? China. You think these cats don't want to get this China money? They all trying to get this China money. They got a chance to go over there and be like, yo, we going to get some more of this China money. And they're like, no, I'd rather stay home with my bustling baby boy. Bouncing baby boy. They bounce, right? Yeah, they bounce. Anyway, yeah, that's what they doing. They staying at home at the crib on all of this. That means that structurally something is just not right here. And the best way to do it, I'm telling you, emphasize young people in this. You'll create more stars, you'll make better young players, and whatever event you decide to highlight with the stars, you will wind up making that a bigger deal. I also say, if I was Paul George, I would never show up to get ready for no World Cup. You remember that one time he was getting ready for the World Cup and then he broke his leg in pieces?
Yeah, I mean, you can't blame players for not wanting to get hurt, spending that extra time out there, especially after a long, grueling season.
Yeah, no, man, I'm out here for what? For what? You know, like, no. No, thanks. I understand that people are like, yo, you know, we out here, you know, you can go out here, you have the chance to represent your country. You know, cats ain't representing their country. They represent USA basketball. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is not the same thing. All right, we'll be back in a minute to talk about Chris Paul stopping NBA players from going broke. But first, you've heard us talk about Hims and how they are helping guys look their best. If you haven't, it's time to see what they're all about. Look, man, 66% of men lose their hair by age 35. That's me. And it's a big problem. The thing is, once you start to notice hair loss, it's too late. Best way to prevent more hair loss is to do something about it while you still have some. Time to get a handle on those precious locks. How you feel a year from now if it's still business as usual up there? You don't have to turn to weird solutions or do nothing when you can turn to medicine and science. The solution is for Hims.com. One-stop shop for hair loss, skincare, and other wellness supplements for men. Hims is helping guys be the best version of themselves with licensed physicians and FDA-approved products to help treat hair loss. It's prescription solutions backed by science. Now, Hims was created by a guy who knows some men's health conversations are easier online than in person. So it's no more awkward in-person doctors doctor's visits and long pharmacy lines. For Hims connects you to real doctors online, which can save you hours. Completely confidential and discreet. Answer a few questions, a doctor will review, and if they determine it's right for you, can prescribe you medication to treat hair loss that is shipped directly to your door. Get the hair loss treatment everyone is talking about. It's featured in GQ, Men's Health, Esquire, and Playboy, to name a few. Order now. My listeners get started with the Hims Complete Hair Kit for just $5 today. Right now, while supplies last and subject to doctor's approval. See website for full details and safety information. This could cost hundreds if you went to the doctor or pharmacy somewhere else. Go to forhims.com/Bomani. That's FORHIMS.com/Bomani. Forhims.com/Bomani. All right. So there's a story in The Athletic. Not sure if you saw this, but Chris Paul and Joe Smith are trying to help you fix your life if you're a basketball player. Well, fix your life is probably a bit dramatic, but not really. Basically, Chris Paul wants to improve financial literacy among NBA players, and he's bringing Joe Smith with him because Joe Smith, he's scared straight. Joe Smith made $60 million. Last year, Joe Smith had $3,000 to his name. And he said that part of it with Joe was bad divorce after he stopped playing. So he had a bad divorce, some bad, like, real estate investments. Those sorts of things. Like, it wasn't just, and, you know, of course, you know, your family wants money and stuff like that. But it wasn't just like, oh, my God, you're so dumb, man. It's a couple of breaks. And the next thing you know, all your money is out the door. And so Chris Paul said, you know, one thing about the NBA locker room, he's like, I hear guys talk about literally everything in the world except for money. And that, I don't think, makes NBA basketball players any different than anybody else. Like, social decorum involves not really talking about money. Now, of course, in the NBA, it's a little bit of a different situation because everybody knows how much money everybody makes. Or even if they don't know, it is one Google away to find out what everybody's salary is. But, like, Gabe, I like to think we're friends, right? I don't, forgive me if I'm overstepping my bounds, but I like to think that we're friends.
I would say so.
I don't know how much money you make. I have no idea. You have really no idea how much money I make outside of my watch. Like, this is not a thing that is discussed anywhere. But I guess it's particularly disheartening if you think about it with the NBA, because those cats are living lives that basically only, like, the only people they know that can really relate to it are each other. Like, nobody's in that same sort of situation. I mean, other athletes, yeah, but you know what I mean? But like, this is something that you think they need to talk about because I have no idea who else in the world you're going to talk about these things with. Like, I don't have much stuff that comes up with money, but like, I mean, it does kind of like, you're coming to some money out of nowhere. It changes your life in some ways, but it's not a very large number of people that I feel like I can go talk to about what these things are and some of the problems that come with it and everything else. But in the NBA, man, they got each other. One would think that would be the play, or you would think that there would be some old heads in there who are just kind of like hipping people to game in various ways. So I give you an example of how this can work. A gentleman named Eric Rideholm runs the television show I work on. He runs PTI. He does Around the Horn. He does Highly Questionable, all those things. But Eric was a co-founder of a little something called The Motley Fool, an investment newsletter that some of you might be familiar with. So Eric does, like, he is an investor. He does good things. A couple weeks ago, I went and met with Eric because Eric told me if you ever want to talk about investment, we can do that. And what he basically did was that demonstration that the guy did on Hard Knocks on compound interest. Did you ever see that, Gabe?
I did not.
Well, basically, he just told, you know, just told them how compound interest worked. And I didn't realize how many people, like, didn't understand compound interest as a concept. Like, that's privilege, making me overestimate the things that people know. But, like, I sat down with Eric, and Eric is like, yo, so if you put $1,000 in at a 10% return and you put $1,000 in every year for 50 years, he pulls up the number. I can't remember exactly what the number was, but I feel like it was something like $1.6 million. Or something like that, right? Like, that is a very basic notion and concept that most people kind of sort of don't know. But my boss is an investor and a guy who loves to talk about that stuff. And so I just went in with him and we sat in the office and he, you know, did that demonstration and then just kind of talked to me kind of philosophically about what kinds of decisions he makes when it comes to playing the market and his general theory on investing in the stock market and why he does it and everything else. And I am very fortunate that I had like a person in my life that I could go to and just kind of run through that. Like some of it I knew, certainly it kind of helped me contextualize, those things, but I'm not the person who needs it like super bad to be able to go in and do those things. But these cats in the league do. Like I remember when that Hard Knocks segment, that part was on about the dude doing compound interest, and I really was just kind of like, I rolled my eyes at it to a degree. But that was bad on me because I just didn't do enough math on the idea that, yo, man, people don't know this stuff. Like I often find when people say that we're going to talk about what financial literacy is, I always want people to be a little clearer on what financial literacy is, because people seem to think that this so-called notion of financial literacy is going to fix everybody's life. Like I saw something, I forget where the story was. People got mad at me what I had to say about it, but it was some story talking about how they're going to start teaching financial literacy in these schools, and that was to counteract the fact that folks don't have savings. And I'm like, a lack of financial literacy is not why they don't have savings in many cases. In many cases, the reason they don't have savings is because they don't have money. Like you can make somebody as literate as you want them to be, can't read if you don't have eyes, you know? And so like people need the money, certainly. And so I think that people look at that as just like a cure all, like, yo, the problem is people don't understand money. And my inclination on that has always been, here's the biggest thing you need to understand about money. Stop spending all of it. Right. Like what I think, and again, I ain't no financial literacy consultant or anything like that. I'm just a dude. But I've always thought the biggest thing for me, at least as a younger person getting older, that I had never properly done the math on is how far and wide what if ranged. Right. Like the things that could come up, the rainy day type stuff. I had totally underestimated like how many things there were in your adult life that might come up and cost you some money. I just didn't have a grasp on that. So since I didn't have a grasp on that, I didn't truly have a grasp on what saving meant and like what you need to save to be prepared for whatever might happen. Like I thought I could just, you know, need to throw a little money off to the side or something like that. But I didn't know what all the things were that I might need to be prepared for. And young people have poor risk calculus and tend to do things that are incredibly chancy and put themselves in terrible situations as a result. But my thought has always been, stop spending all that money, right? Like that's the thing that you got to do. And I'd always imagine that was difficult for athletes in particular about this, because athletes, I feel like, unlike musicians, for example, and actors, athletes get paid on a regular schedule. That regular schedule might only be 6 months out the year, but athletes get paid on a regular schedule. And so can you imagine if you were 22 years old, what your attitude about saving would be if you knew that in a couple of days, somebody about to drop $100,000 in your bank account. And you can run that account all the way down. And you know what's going to happen in 2 weeks? Somebody going to give you $100,000 more dollars. And then you wait a couple of weeks, you can run that whole thing down, and it's cool. I get paid on Friday. You know what I mean? Like this money's going to come around on Friday, so I'm going to give me another $100,000. You can always start saving a little bit later because somebody about to give you $100,000. Like I think this happens with football players in particular because they only get paid out on those 17 checks, you know? Like, hey, you a first round pick and you making, let's say, call it $5 million a year. That check going to come in every week. Every week. Hey, you run that money all the way down. It's cool. I get paid on Friday. Because that's young person's thinking. And I think that all of us, well, I can't say all, but I think a lot of us, when we were young, that was the attitude that we had. That was the way we approached these things. Nah, it's cool, baby. I get paid on Friday. Like, that's what it was going to be. And so I can easily see how tricky that gets for these young guys that have all this money thrown in front of them and who have had a lot of people who have been handling a lot of their affairs for them. I see how all of that goes. I am surprised to hear, though, that there aren't more old heads that just go tap the dudes on the shoulder and be like, hey, man, I saw you coming here with another one of them chains, baby. I'm trying to tell you, this ain't the way for you to do it. This ain't it. Like, to me, the best thing an old head could do for a young head in a situation like that is recommend somebody to help them with their money. Because I feel bad. Like, somebody actually from the Motley Fool got into my mentions. I said this on television. So he got in my mentions and said, yo, here's something on how to pick a financial advisor. But, like, if you're just a dude, like a 19, 20-year-old dude, how are you supposed to figure out who's supposed to be running your money for you? The best you can do is get a recommendation from somebody. How you know that recommendation is a good one? Like, Abe, I think you noticed this, like the stuff with the college coaches and everything else. The game that these hustlers are on is trying to get in as the financial advisor for these dudes so they can get the commissions off their accounts. How many people around those folks know how to properly vet a financial advisor? Because I'll be honest with you, I don't really know how to properly vet a financial advisor. I took a recommendation from a friend. By the way, a friend I don't hang out with no more because I felt like he tried to take some of my money. Now, I worked okay with the money, dude. That was fine. But you understand what I'm saying? I got 2 master's degrees in economics. I didn't know where to go to get somebody like to figure out who to trust with my money. I didn't know. I mean, it's going okay, I think. You know, man, it's going okay. Better be going okay. It's going all right. But I just imagine that's really, really tough. And so, you know, that 30 for 30 broke that Billy Corbin did. I think, and I think I've seen this, where Billy Corbin, I think, went into this thinking he was just going to have this story with these amazing numbers. Like, oh, my God, look how much money these guys lost. And I don't know if Billy was looking at it this way, but I do think that for the audience, the response is going to be, how dumb is that you lose all that money? And then I think Billy got in there and started talking to them cats and was like, oh, my God, like, there's real human beings here, but these are really kind of tragic stories of what has gone on. And a lot of time, it wasn't these guys' fault. And that was before we got to your people trying to get your money from you. Bernie Kosar said in that movie, I think he said he had to write his dad a $1 million check to get him out of his life. Like, all this stuff, it's just not as easy as people want it to be. And I understand the idea where people talk about, man, being rich is hard. I don't know about that. But everybody's response is, well, I'd love to find out. And you can go ahead and find out, but I do think you're going to find out with these dudes, the challenges are far greater than people give them credit for being. And the real one, like, I think I may have mentioned this earlier, man, but them cats get caught on them real estate deals, on those bad investments, because somebody comes up with some bright idea, and then you throw them hundreds of thousands of dollars, or you give somebody too much access to your money, and they throw, like, millions of dollars at it, and next thing you know, you look up, and all that money gone. There's been a whole lot of dudes throughout this who just got by having the wrong financial advisor, because chances are, also, you dealing with financial advisors that don't really respect you. Like, these cats look like easy marks. Whole lot of them sitting around waiting for the moment they can go ahead and get you. Did you see that? What, Kevin Garnett got for $77 million by somebody? I think Tim Duncan got for $20 million from somebody. Hey, what'd you do if somebody got you for $77 million?
I'd be mad as hell, man.
So, I'm going to tell you a story. Not going to tell you who it's about. But I know of an example of a dude who saw broke, and that prompted him to show up at his financial advisor's office with, shall we say, a party favor to let him know what would happen if he ever thought to steal that dude's money from him. Now, I don't know too much about how to vet a financial advisor, Gabe, but I feel like that financial advisor will never steal from that man. What do you think?
Man, I have trouble picking a dentist, let alone a financial advisor.
Let me tell you this. If I'm a financial advisor and that dude walk in with the keep it on me and says, look, I don't think you should steal from me, that's not the guy I'm going to steal from. I'm going to find some other guy who, on the other hand, trusts me a little bit too much. Not this guy who has a clear set of rules.
We know you can't be on top of all the news and information of the day. No need for the social media feeds. We got you. Now, if you haven't heard.
All right, Bomani, this first story comes from entertainment.
Hey, this is Taylor Hosking, culture staff writer here at Vice. Last week, we finally got more details about an instance in Iowa where a director of their human services department, Jerry Foxhoven, was abruptly asked to resign by the governor, and some suspected it was because he was too obsessed with the rapper Tupac Shakur. He had been sending a lot of emails lacing in inspirational Tupac quotes and created this thing called Tupac Fridays where he would play his music around the office. And after some of his colleagues complained about it, he still went ahead and sent his final email, which celebrated Father's Day and Tupac's birthday, with a photo of him encouraging staff to listen to one of his records over the weekend. And even though Foxhoven told the Associated Press he didn't think he was asked to resign for his Tupac fandom, the Iowa governor's office has still refused to tell him or the press why he was asked to resign, even though they're legally obligated to. So we might not ever know what really happened there, but it's been really fun to see Tupac fans and hip-hop fans rallying around this 66-year-old white state official whose casual hobby practically turned into social activism for his favorite rapper.
I just want to know how he got into Tupac in the first place.
That would be a really interesting story.
Like, I need to know if he ever went to a Tupac concert. I need to know if he called the radio station after Tupac died. I need to know if he's the dude that was buying all the posthumous Tupac mixtapes and albums. I have all the questions in that. Also, has he read Soul on Ice? Like, I feel like this is the sort of guy who would have read Soul on Ice. I would love to have a discussion with this gentleman about the New York 21. I have so many questions about just how far he went into his Tupac fandom. And while they say he was offering inspirational quotes from Tupac, I am pretty familiar with the Tupac catalog. And don't get this twisted, there are some inspirational quotes in there. There are some inspirational songs in the Tupac catalog. But for all I know, this guy's version of inspiration could be, "Put a little twist in your hips because I'm watching." That might have been his jam. I don't know. I feel very confident that this whole thing gonna fall apart when you go on his phone and you find out that he has a group text that is entitled "Strictly for My N-Words." Like, if you're a real Tupac fan, that right there, that's what he's talking about. Also, does his Tupac fandom stretch to Digital Underground? Is this man a fan of Shock G? Is he a Humpty Hump fan? I feel like you kind of got to be if you really dig Tupac in that way. I want to know what era Tupac is his favorite. I want to know at what point he felt like it was him against the world. I need to know what exactly it is about Tupac that speaks to this man. And I also don't blame them for firing him, because if I know anything about this world, there is no arguing with a Tupac fan. You can't argue with them. You just walk away, or in this case, walk him away with security.
I think we might need to get this guy in the right time.
I'm down. Find a way.
This next story comes from music.
This is Michael Wood, pop music critic at the Los Angeles Times. As most humans know, this past weekend, Disney released its new remake of The Lion King. And along with the movie, there's a new album from Beyoncé, who voices the role of Nala in the film. It's not exactly a new Beyoncé record, per se. There's new tracks from her, along with stuff by Jay-Z and Childish Gambino, and Kendrick Lamar, whose Black Panther soundtrack last year was clearly a model for this record. Like Kendrick's album, this one also features a lot of African artists. Artists like Mr. Easy and WizKid and Burna Boy. And in a lot of ways, the album is more impressive than the movie itself. Now, that's nothing new for Beyoncé. This is the woman who easily outshone Coldplay during that band's Super Bowl halftime performance a few years ago. Nobody takes possession of a cultural space like Beyoncé does. Yeah, this album loosely ties in with some of the themes of the movie, Simba's relationship with his late father, Mufasa. But what she's really doing here is taking up a lot of the same ideas she's been addressing in her own work lately. She's singing about legacy and family and cultural ownership. She's singing about the beauty and the durability of brown skin, as she puts it, in a song called Brown Skin Girl that features her and Jay-Z's daughter, Blue Ivy. And by collaborating with African artists, she's shedding more light on that continent in a way than the movie does. Part of that is her interest in African music, which Beyoncé fans know she's touched on before, and part of it is, of course, the tie-in with the movie, which is set in Africa. But it also feels to me like Beyoncé is taking stock of how global pop music is right now, as we've seen with the explosion in the US of K-pop and Latin pop.
I use this as a way to talk about that Lion King movie. Gabe, have you seen it?
I did. I went to the Disney screening on Saturday morning with a bunch of kids.
How was it?
Well, oh, no shade.
It's Disney, isn't it?
No shade, but I did feel like the theater did a little bit of an underwhelming job with projecting the screening. The projector was like a little bit off in terms of like the lining up on the screen. And then as the guy next to me said, there was no bass in the movie. So the surround sound wasn't on. But other than that, it was fine.
Yeah, I haven't been able to decide how I feel about the idea of like live action Lion King.
Well, better get ready because there's about to be a whole lot more live action Disney movies.
Okay, so like they pay the bills, right? So I'm not saying this about Disney. Just saying in the game. Y'all can't come up with no new ideas. Like I personally was not sitting around wanting to see all my old movies new. You know why? I could just watch the old ones. Is it just me?
Well, so interestingly enough, you want to know who I ran into when I was stepping out the theater?
Who?
Florida James.
Really?
Yes. Saw Florida James, saw Kareem there also. And Florida James, his point was that you shouldn't redo a perfect movie.
Good point.
Why take a second pass at this? But then I've also seen like, Donald Glover, I believe he said in some interview, like, oh, it's our duty now that we have this technology to kind of reimagine things and bring them into the new age. And I was like, I don't know about that.
Nah, sorry, buddy. I disagree.
All right. This last story comes from Tech.
Hey, I'm April Glazer and I write for Slate. And I read an article last week called How Not to Build a Panopticon. And in that, I write about Amazon's Ring doorbell system. Those are those smart camera doorbells that you maybe have seen or you know people that have outside their home to see if someone has stolen a package or if someone's breaking in. Well, increasingly, Amazon is partnering with police departments across the country, like in Dallas and Philadelphia and Oklahoma City and smaller cities as well, to gain access to residential cameras. What they're doing is helping police sell these cameras at discounted rates or even give them away for free, and then encouraging residents to allow police to access footage from those cameras when they want, when they ask for it. It's kind of creating a residential kind of consumer-powered street-level surveillance operation in our cities across the country, and they're partnering with Amazon to do this, and Amazon's trying to get in more police departments around the country. Now, this is coming after Amazon has also tried to work with police departments, and we know they're already working with the FBI, and they've pitched to ICE for this. And I'm talking about its facial recognition system called Recognition. Now, Amazon also recently ended a pilot with its facial recognition system in Orlando, Florida. We learned that that pilot didn't work very well because Orlando's computer system just wasn't advanced enough to handle Amazon's high tech, right? And this is something Amazon is going to have to deal with if it tries to partner directly with police departments to install its surveillance products, that, you know, Amazon's tech might be more advanced than the municipal infrastructure it's working with. Whereas if it works with residents to just kind of open their feeds and allow police to access footage from residential cameras, they don't have that same kind of technical hurdle. And then they also get partnerships with police to maybe procure more surveillance technology in the future. And all of this leads to the fact that Amazon is really just not an online store. It hasn't been just an online store for a while. It's increasingly also a surveillance technology company.
So like somebody broke in next door neighbor, the people in the store, my parents, somebody broke in their car, though I said can't say broke in because left the door open. But anyway, I saw the clip on the Ring camera or whatever it's called, the Nest. Either way, it was one of them joints that you could look at and see what happened. The thing is, once that happens, like, you turn that over to the police, right? Like, it's the whole point is to find out who did it. And unless you're going to be engaging in some vigilante justice, then you have to give this over to the cops in order to make anything happen. At least that's how it looks like. You know, that would be what the game is to me. But, yo, man, we are so complicit in our own destruction. And I understand the idea and why people want to do these things. But in the end, like, you think the police going to see you doing their work for them and they're not going to come ask you for it in one form or fashion? That they're not going to come ask you for it? So, yeah, man, we are watched at all times. This is, Gabe, it makes me nervous.
Yeah, I mean, this is the literal eye in the sky.
Yes. Yes.
In your neighborhood.
Yes. This is where we are.
Hey, this is Bomani. You have reached the right time voicemail. Say whatever you want. Get creative with it. But this is your place to talk back to the show. So talk back. Peace.
All right, Bomani. Were you in town this past weekend or were you out of town?
A little of both.
So you experienced part of the heat wave.
Oh, yeah, it was hot.
That hit the East Coast and Midwest to a certain degree. It was ungodly hot. At least in Connecticut, it was 100 degrees plus humidity, so it feels like it's like 110, 120. And as a West Coaster, I know what 100 degrees feels like out on the West Coast when it's dry heat. This was not that.
It was, and we got all the, well, you don't, well, over here, we got a lot of concrete. That makes it worse.
Yeah, it was atrocious. So it spawned a question, like, what is the craziest thing that you have seen during a heat wave, or what have you seen heat do that was the craziest thing you've ever seen? Got some interesting responses. Our first one is from Don in California.
Hey, what's up, Bo? This is Don in California. I have a great story when it came to how hot it was. I'm in California. I'm a dark-skinned black male. This is when I found out it was 120 degrees. We're in a pool, so we figure we're safe. It's pretty cool in a pool. However, I did not know black people could actually get sunburned. And then I looked on the back of my shoulders and was like, what is this blistering and why does it hurt to touch my back? And everybody's like, you get sunburned. I'm like, no, black people don't get sunburned. Yeah, you get sunburned and chlorine makes it 10 times worse. So this is a disclaimer for black people that don't believe dark people get sunburned. Yeah, we do. So talk to you guys later.
Yo, I used to believe that too. And in retrospect, I don't understand how it is that I believe that, because all it took to change my mind was getting sunburned. And maybe it's just a matter of as you get older, you get sunburned more easily. I have no idea, but I feel like I should have learned this as a child with all that time I spent out there in the sun. Like, I used to remember this, man. White folks would come back to school from all kinds of stuff, and they'd be all sunburned. And it never happened to me, never happened to anybody I knew. I really thought that this was not something that could happen to us. I thought melanin had even more superpowers than it appears to. Nah, dog, it does not. I am Captain Sunscreen now.
The sun does things to people. I'll leave it at that.
Yeah. Oh, boy. No. Sunburn is mad unpleasant, man. Mad unpleasant. Because sunburn always, wherever sunburn is going to get you, it ain't something you can hide. Like, sunburn gets you back. How you going to sit in a chair?
Living in fear, man. Living in fear.
Totally.
Our next one comes from L in St. Louis.
What up, Bo? This is L from St. Louis. I moved to Phoenix, Arizona a few years ago. Stayed down there for a couple years, and the craziest thing I've seen, you know, Arizona, everybody always says it's a dry heat. Man, that don't make a difference. 115, God, that's hot. So one day I worked in a warehouse, and the dude was like, hey, man, I'm going to show you something. This is how hot it is down here. The next day, he came in with a pack of uncooked cookies and a pan, greased the pan up about 11:30. Put the cookies on the pan, took them out to his car, and about 30, 45 minutes later, we had freshly baked cookies fresh out the car. That's the craziest thing I hear. So if anybody would tell you that Arizona heat is a dry heat, it don't make it do it, you know, it make it a little better, then they lying to you, dog.
Yo, he baked cookies in the car?
I've seen people, like, cook meat and stuff on, like, a hood of a car, too.
Yeah, I love that he called them freshly baked cookies. Because let me tell you, I don't know if that was the safest thing they ever did, but it definitely sounds like those cookies were subsequently eaten.
Yes, right? Because they were cooked to him. They looked good. They were ready to eat.
Let me tell you, man. I had a girlfriend in college who had gone to some convention in Arizona, and she was from New Orleans. And New Orleans is as hot as any place in the world, at least in terms of how it feels. She said she went out there. You know, people always talk that dry heat. Jeez, I should remember getting on the phone. She's like, let me tell you about this dry heat. You know what else is a dry heat? A hair dryer. That's real. That's how I felt in Vegas. I was in Vegas, man. This Uber driver told me that he had a convertible. He had just moved down there from, like, Michigan. He said he had a convertible. He said he took that top down. He said he got on the road. And the next thing he did was hit that button and put that top right back up.
I have family that are from Fresno and out in California, which is like out there in the Central Valley. It would get so hot that I'd be in a pool in the summer and I'd scoop like a handful of water out onto the asphalt and the water would boil on the ground. after, just straight from the pool.
Wow.
This next one comes from Steve in Baltimore.
Hey, Bo, this is Steve from Baltimore. Back in the day, I grew up in the project here in Baltimore. And, you know, the older guys used to open the fire hydrants up, you know, throw water on in the neighborhood, throw cans in the water, you know, maybe even throw a couple of, quote-unquote, drug users in the water. And they would also throw buckets of water on people's cars as they drove down. Okay, everybody, you know, it was hot. Everybody getting water splashed on them. Well, there was this one particular couple, older Caucasian couple, and they had their sunroof open. And they're like, no, I'm not going to shut my sunroof. These guys won't throw water on. They're not going to throw water on my car. And, of course, these older guys, one of them being my cousin, built up a five-gallon water bucket. And the light turned red. And he sat there and took this water bucket and dumped it inside of their sunroof, drenching them the whole inside of their car. Yeah, they got out. They pulled over. They got out. They started cussing. It was the funniest thing I ever seen because it was the summertime back in the day in the project. All right, man.
So let me explain the difference to you right fast about Baltimore and Texas. In Baltimore, this happens. And you get the bright idea to pour the water in the sunroof. And you feel pretty confident that that white man in that car is just going to drive home and be mad after he cusses you out. I am from Texas. If I pour water in that white man's car and then he stopped and got out, do you know how lucky I am if the only thing he's doing is cussing? Please just cuss me out. That's all I want you to do. Just, yeah, please curse all the way. Because you need to be paying attention inside that sunroof before that man get out that car to see if he goes to any of the following places. Under the seat. The glove compartment. The center console. Or, you know, his belt. Kids, don't try that one at home. Okay? You with me?
I'm with you. Story sounded like it might have a little bit more impact than a guy in Texas whose track spikes melted.
Yeah, I think that's fair. That's fair. Although that is pretty wild that his track spikes melted. That is a lot. But, I mean, don't get shot because it's hot outside. Hey, ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time. We do this thing here a couple times a week. My man Gabe Bassane handles everything behind the scenes. Thank you, sir. Thank you to our sponsor for hymns.com. Also, thank you to our If You Haven't Heard contributors. Thanks to Taylor Hosking of Vice. Check out her story on that crazy Tupac fan that got fired from his job in Iowa. And thanks to Michael Wood of the LA Times. Check out his story on Beyonce doing the Lion King soundtrack at latimes.com. Also, thank you to April Glazer of Slate. Check out her story about Amazon and their cameras and the police and everybody working together in ways that should scare you. Be sure to check out the Woj Pod this week. His guest is Wizards General Manager Tommy Shepard. Talk about Brad Beal's contract and his vision for the team. Also, subscribe to The Right Time wherever you get your podcast. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to think you are a hater. And next week, Lonnie O'Neill of The Undefeated will join us. The Right Time Book Club on Jim Brown, The Fierce Life of an American Hero by Mike Freeman. We'll talk about chapters 3 and 4 next week. Be sure to tweet about that to Gabe with your questions with the hashtag The Right Time Book Club. All right, talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or subscribe on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.
The Right Time with Bomani Jones is presented by Goodyear. Discover the possibilities. Goodyear, more driven.